Okay, Hitler's War by David Irving. Clearing the decks. Hitler knew that his pact with Stalin was misunderstood. In his speech to the generals, he had laid bare his own suspicions. Russia is at present harmless, he assured them. Pacts are respected only until they no longer serve a purpose. Russia will abide by the pact only as long as she considers it to her advantage. Stalin had far-reaching goals, and among them were the strengthening of Russia's position in the Baltic, which Germany could only oppose once she was unencumbered in the West, the expansion of Russian influence in the Balkans, and a drive toward the Persian Gulf. It was the aim of German foreign policy that Russia should be deflected toward the Persian Gulf, as this would bring her into conflict with Britain, but she must be kept out of the Balkans. Hitler hoped that the present situation between Germany and Russia would prevail for 2 or 3 more years, but if Stalin were to die, there might be a rapid and ugly volte-face in the Kremlin. I think I got that right. There was clear evidence of the Russian military buildup, of a Russian military buildup. Laskowitz reported from Poland that 4 military airfields were being built, and 200 to 300 Russian bombers had been counted around Bialystok. In addition, wrote Blaskowitz, Russian propaganda was making plain that this was nothing less than a war against fascism. Germany is said in the USSR to be planning an attack on Russia as soon as she is victorious in the West. Therefore, Russia must be on guard to exploit Germany's weakness at the right moment. The general's command had clearly identified Russian espionage and communist subversive activity behind German lines in Poland. In short, Hitler must conclude that war with Russia was inevitable, and that victory would go to the side which was ready first. To strengthen her position in the Baltic, Russia now made demands of Finland. When Finland snubbed the Russians, the Red Army attacked on the last day of November 1939. Hitler had abandoned Finland to the Soviet influence in the secret codicil to the August Pact with Stalin, and he instructed his foreign missions to adhere to an anti-Finnish line. For the integrity of his brittle pact with Stalin was to be his most powerful weapon in the attack on France. The Führer even agreed to a Russian request for the transfer of fuel and provisions from German steamships to Soviet submarines blockading Finland. Under the economic treaty signed between the two powers on August 19th, Russia was to supply Germany with raw materials. It was also to act as a safe channel to Germany for goods exported by Japan, Manchuria, Afghanistan, Iran, and Romania, but subject to British naval blockade. Hitler also needed the oil produced in Russia and Soviet-occupied Poland, and he knew that Stalin could exert pressure to control the supply of Romanian oil to Germany. It thus behooved him to behave like a proverbial friend in need, and throughout the winter he was a friend indeed as he instructed his military and economic authorities to do their utmost to meet Russian demands. Russia's list of requirements was not easy to fulfill. The Russians wanted the half-built cruiser Lützow and the aircraft carrier Graf Zeppelin. They also wanted the blueprints of these and even more up-to-date German warships, including the Bismarck and the Tirpitz. They asked for sets of the heaviest ship's armament, and for the 50,000 or 57,000 blueprints prepared for the new Krupp 406mm triple turret guns, the fire control sets, and the ammunition that went with them. The Soviet Navy wanted samples of accumulators and periscopes for submarines. They wanted a supply of top-grade German armor plate for a cruiser to be built in Russia, and they wanted hydroacoustical gear, torpedoes, and mines as well. Jesus. Hitler told Raeder that his only anxiety in handing over the blueprints of the battleship Bismarck to the Russians was that these revealed that the vessel had been planned on a far larger scale than was permitted by the international agreements binding on Germany at the time. Raeder assured him it would take the Russians 6 years to copy the Bismarck. However, he conceded that it would be unfortunate if the blueprints fell into British hands. Hitler had assigned to his navy a largely passive role in the war. He initially forbade his submarines to attack even Anglo-French naval forces. During the first year of the war, The German Navy had on average only a dozen submarines with which to blockade the British Isles. Since the Luftwaffe was given priority in raw materials, the Navy's steadily reduced steel allocation further limited its expansion. In one respect, however, Raeder had an advantage over Brauchitsch and Goering. To Hitler, the sea was an unwholesome element, an area of uncertainty. He did not understand, and he was relieved to trust Grand Admiral Raeder to act as he saw fit. Thus, German destroyers executed bold sorties into the very jaws of the enemy, laying magnetic minefields in the estuaries of the principal British rivers. A U-boat sank the aircraft carrier Courageous. Another U-boat penetrated Scapa Flow and torpedoed the battleship Royal Oak. See, you tone down the bureaucracy and shit gets done. In the South Atlantic, the Graf Spree had now begun raiding enemy convoys, but the Luftwaffe, and Goering particularly, wanted to bring the war closer to Britain's shores. When on November 28th, in reprisal for the German mining of the coastal waters, Britain issued an order in council blockading Germany's export shipments, Goering and Milch hurried to Hitler with proposals for a crushing Luftwaffe offensive against British shipyards, docks, and ports. Hitler turned down the Luftwaffe's idea, but he did issue a new directive specifying that the best way to defeat Britain would be to paralyze her trade. The German Navy and the Luftwaffe were to turn to this task as soon as Yellow had been successfully completed. Since Hitler would then control the Channel coast, the Luftwaffe really could attack on the lines Goering had proposed. In October 1939, Raeder had left Hitler in no doubt as to Germany's grim strategic position should the British occupy Norway. In winter, all Germany's iron ore requirements passed through the ice-free port at Narvik. German merchant ships and warships would no longer be able to traverse the neutral Norwegian waters. The British Air Force could dominate northern Germany, and the Royal Navy would command the Baltic, though he had realistically advised Hitler that a Norwegian campaign might end in a massacre of the German fleet. Raeder saw no alternative to such a campaign if the strategic dangers inherent in a British occupation of Norway were to be obviated. Raeder's view took Hitler by surprise. Neither his political nor his naval advisors gave him respite once the Russo-Finnish War broke out. At noon on December 11th, Alfred Rosenberg briefed Hitler on a similar idea that had originated with one of his Norwegian contacts, Major Vidkun Quisling. Rosenberg told Hitler that Quisling's idea was that Germany should invade Norway at the request of a government he would himself set up. Ribbentrop and Weizsäcker warned Hitler against even agreeing to see this Norwegian. Hitler told Rosenberg he was willing to meet Quisling. In this conversation, Rosenberg's office recorded, the Führer repeatedly emphasized that what he most preferred politically would be for Norway and, for that matter, all Scandinavia to remain absolutely neutral. He had no intention of enlarging the theaters of war by dragging still more countries into the conflict. If, however, the other side was planning such an enlargement of the war, then he must obviously feel compelled to take steps against the move. In an effort to offset the increasing enemy propaganda activity, the Führer then promised Quisling financial aid for his pan-Germanic movement. Quisling said he had 200,000 followers, many in key positions in Norway. Hitler asked the OKW to draft two alternative options, one following Quisling's suggestion, the other projecting an occupation of Norway by force. Hitler initiated inquiries into Quisling's background and decided not to rely on him for any assistance beyond subversive operations. A number of hand-picked Norwegians would undergo secret guerrilla warfare training in Germany. When Norway was invaded, they were to seize key buildings in Oslo and elsewhere, and thus present the king with a fait accompli. No date for the operation was set. Fait accompli. I don't know how that's pronounced, but the general staff continued their open hostility to Hitler. After his unequivocal speech on November 23rd, General Guderian privately taxed Hitler with his astonishing attitude toward the leaders of an army that had just won such a victory for him in Poland. Hitler retorted that it was the army's commander-in-chief himself who displeased him, adding that there was unfortunately no suitable replacement. Brauchitsch's chief of intelligence noted, "There is as little contact between BR and the Führer as ever. A changeover is planned." Hitler suspected the hand of the general staff against him everywhere. When the Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung published a sensational and sloppy article on the Great Headquarters, Hitler was furious at an implicit suggestion that history was being made by the general staff and not himself. The Führer was, however, hard to please, for when at Christmas the Essener National Zeitung ventured a seasonal comparison between Adolf Hitler and the Messiah, Goebbels confidently informed the entire German press that the Führer would prefer them to abstain from such comparisons in the future. In moments of military crisis, Hitler was to display an indecisiveness and lack of precision that was otherwise wholly out of character. On December 13th, the pocket battleship Graf Spee fell foul of three British cruisers off the coast of neutral Uruguay. It was not until the small hours of the 14th that the first details reached the Berlin Admiralty. "I have taken 15 hits, food stores and galleys destroyed. I am making for Montevideo." To those familiar with the political stance of Uruguay, it was clear the battleship's fighting days were probably over. It would take many days for the damage to be repaired. The government at Montevideo granted only 3 days. Meanwhile, British naval forces began to mass in uncertain strength at the mouth of the Platte River. On the 16th, Raeder arrived at the Chancellery with the latest cable from the battleship. Captain Hans Langsdorff had signaled, "Military situation off Montevideo. Apart from cruisers and destroyers, there are also Ark Royal and Renown. Tightly blocked at night. No prospect of breakout into open sea or reaching home. 2. Propose emerging as far as neutral waters limit. Should it be possible to fight through to Buenos Aires using remaining ammunition, this will be attempted. 3. In the event that breakout would result in certain destruction of Spee with no chance of damaging enemy, I request decision whether to scuttle despite inadequate depth of water. Estuary of the Plate or internment." Hitler met Admiral Raeder at the door of his study with a demand that Graf Spee must attempt to break through to the open sea. If she must go down, at least she could take some of the enemy with her. He put a hand on the admiral's shoulder. "Believe me, the fate of this ship and her crew is as painful to me as to you. But this is war, and when the need is there, one must know how to be harsh." But he followed this firm speech with an inexplicable act. Raeder showed him the admiralty's draft reply to Captain Langsdorff. Graf Spee was to stay at Montevideo as long as the authorities would allow. A breakout to Buenos Aires would be approved if scuttling through thoroughly destroy everything first. This reply was wholly out of keeping with Hitler's heroic demand, but he said nothing. Hitler eagerly awaited the news of Graf Spee's last battle. During the 17th, the stunning news arrived that the battleship had sailed out of Montevideo, discharged her crew into a waiting steamer, and then gently settled down onto the shallow bed of the river's estuary. In a savage mood that evening, Hitler pondered the damage Langsdorff had done to Germany's fighting image. At 3 a.m, he ordered the official announcement altered to read, "Under these circumstances, the Führer ordered Captain Langsdorff to destroy the ship by blowing her up." Langsdorff had been an officer on Jodl's staff. He had been given the Graf Spee, it transpired, as a cure for his chair-bound attitudes. But the cure had apparently not worked. He shot himself on reaching Buenos Aires. His supply ship, Altmark, laden with prisoners plucked from the decks of the battleship's victims, was ordered to return home to Germany. Hitler left Berlin for a brief respite at the Berghof, passing through Munich. He paid his annual Christmas visit to his friends and patrons, the Bruckmanns. He chatted about his plans to conquer Britain by using magnetic mines and other fabulous weaponry. In his entry to the Bruckmanns guest book, he wrote, "In the year of the fight for the creation of the great German Teutonic Reich, for 3 days he toured the Western Front, joining the Christmas celebrations of Luftwaffe squadrons, anti-aircraft batteries, infantry, and SS regiments. On his return to Berlin, Hitler again postponed Yellow, this time to mid-January. Failing a period of cold, clear, wintry weather then, the Führer resolved he would call off Yellow until the spring. He retreated to the Berghof to await the new year. The photographs in Eva Braun's album show that even when the Führer sat faintly smiling at the delight of the offspring of Speer, Goebbels, and Martin Bormann at the Berghof's children's party, he still wore the field gray army tunic, with its solitary iron cross that he had emotionally donned in the days his troops attacked Poland. On the day his troops attacked Poland. In one photograph, however, Hitler is shown in somber evening dress, spooning molten lead into a bowl of water. A New Year's Eve tradition. Some believe that a man's future can be predicted from the contorted shapes that shapes the solidifying metal assumes. Hitler's face betrayed a certain lack of confidence in this procedure. At the Berghof, he received a long, angry, and indeed frightened letter from Benito Mussolini. It broke months of silence and marked the lowest point in Axis relations, which had been soured by Hitler's continued flirting with Moscow. As recently as December 22nd, Hitler had, on Stalin's 60th birthday, cabled him greetings coupled with his best wishes for the Soviet peoples. Stalin had cordially replied. In Mussolini's eyes, Hitler was a traitor to the fascist revolution. He had sacrificed the principles of that revolution to the tactical requirements of one given moment. And he said, "You cannot abandon the anti-Semitic and anti-Bolshevist banners which have flown for 20 years, Mussolini admonished him, and for which so many of your comrades died. The solution for your Lebensraum is in Russia and nowhere else." In this letter, which Hitler deliberately left unanswered for 2 more months, Mussolini also proposed that Hitler should take steps to restore some kind of Polish state. Hitler's policy in Poland had undergone a radical change in the autumn of 1939. Early in October, he had indicated to Governor General Frank that the general government was to be a kind of Polish reservation, but in November he bluntly told Frank, "We are going to keep the general government. We will never give it back." Hitler saw no great urgency about the matter and had himself told Himmler in the autumn of 1939, "I don't want these Eastern Gauleiters in a frantic race to be the first to report to me after 2 or 3 years. Mein Führer, my Gau is fully Germanized. I want the population to be racially flawless, and I'll be quite satisfied if a Gauleiter can report that in 10 years. Himmler, however, wanted greater urgency. Acting on a cruel directive which he had issued at the end of October, the two Gauleiters concerned, Forster and Greiser, and SS Generals Kruger and Odalil Glabachnik, police commanders based in Krakow and Lublin, respectively, began the ruthless midwinter expulsion from their domains of the 550,000 Jews and the principal anti-German and intellectual elements. They used Frank's general government as a dumping ground. In some respects, Hitler did act as a brake. From Himmler's scrawled notes, we know that he was obliged to report to Hitler in person on the shooting of 380 Jews at Ostrow on November 19th, and that when at the end of November, the Archbishop and Suffragan Bishop of Lublin were condemned to death along with 13 priests for the possession of firearms and subversive literature, Hitler ordered their reprieve and deportation to Germany instead. Events in Poland still disturbed the army. A ripple of protest disturbed the German armies poised in the west to unleash Yellow. Hitler learned that on January 22nd, Major General Friedrich Meith, Chief of Staff of the First Army, had told his assembled officers about atrocities in Poland. "The SS has carried out mass executions without proper trials. There have been disturbances." Meith was dismissed. Soon after, the army's commander-in-chief East, General Johannes Blaskowitz, sent to Berlin a formal list of specific SS atrocities in Poland, including murder and looting. "The view that the Polish people can be intimidated and kept down by terrorism will definitely be proven wrong," he warned, and added, "They are far too resilient a people for that." Blazkowicz added that the atrocities would provide the enemy with powerful ammunition throughout the world. Hitler does appear to have issued orders to Hans Frank for a regular prophylactic massacres of the Polish intelligentsia. How else can Frank's confidential remarks at the end of May 1940 to his police authorities in Poland be interpreted? The Führer has said to me, the problem of dealing with and safeguarding German interests in the general government is a matter for the men in charge of the general government and for them alone. And he used these words, the ruling class that we have already unearthed in Poland is to be exterminated. We must keep close watch on whatever grows up in its place, and dispose of that too after a suitable time has elapsed. And Frank hastened to recommend to his minions, there's no need for us to cart off all these elements to concentration camps in the Reich first. That'll just result in a lot of bother and unnecessary correspondence with next of kin. No, we'll liquidate this business here on the spot. Yeah. There it is. The directive issued by the 18th Army on its transfer to Poland in August 1940 is an eloquent statement of the Army's surrender to the party. For centuries, an ethnological struggle has raged along with our eastern frontier. To put an end to it once and for all has called for a short, sharp solution. Specific party and government agencies have been put in charge of waging this ethnological war in the east. This is why our soldiers must keep their noses out of what these units are doing. In the east, Hitler too turned a blind eye on the excesses. An army major procured the arrest of eight Polish whores and put four of them clumsily to death in prison that evening. Hitler commuted the major's death sentence to a prison term. In another case, one of the innumerable young SA officers appointed magistrate in Poland shot 55 Polish prisoners in a drunken orgy. Here, too, the local Galater Greiser begged the Ministry of Justice not to blight the young officer's promising career, and Hitler granted him a reprieve. Within Germany itself, Himmler's police agencies were now acting as a law unto themselves. At the end of September 1939, the Minister of Justice submitted to Hitler a file on summary executions of Germans. Hitler replied that he had not given Himmler any general instruction, that he had ordered certain executions himself. Oh, wait a minute. Hitler replied that he had not given Himmler any general instruction, but that he had ordered certain executions himself. This is why he has now ordered the Tetlau bank robbers to be put before a firing squad, his staff explained. But the files show that Hitler drew much of his information on civilian crime from casual references in the newspapers. A thoughtless editor had only to headline a story, Man Swindled Soldiers' Wives, for the Führer to send Schaub scurrying to a telephone with instructions that the Führer had ordered the man shot. Hitler's attitude to the party's own courts was even more ambivalent, as his reaction to the trial of Julius Streicher showed. Streicher's enemies were legion, but Hitler still saw in him an idealist and true revolutionary. 4 days after Hitler's secret speech to the Galaters in October, Streicher had revealed Hitler's military plans to local party members in a speech, and he had repeated this imprudent step in a larger assembly a few days later. Speaking of Hitler's decision to invade neutral Belgium, Streicher had explained, "We need a coast for our attack on Britain. We need the coast for our attack on Britain." His recent speeches had included blasphemous attacks on the clergy, libelous references to generals of the Great War, and an address to a young female audience in November in which he exhorted them to find a nothing improper in the desire to seduce married men. Any woman or lady who gets worked up about this is, in my eyes, just a pig. The party's Supreme Court, 6 Galaters and 3 party judges, met in February 1940, and on the 16th they ruled against Streicher. Hitler suspended him from office and forbade him to make further public speeches, but he was not ejected from the party, as Hess had demanded, and he was allowed to continue publishing his newspapers, including the despicable Stürmer. Characteristically, Hitler was unhappy with even this mild verdict. He told the other party leaders, like Lay, that he felt an injustice had been done to Stryker. The legalists, he said, had paid too little attention to Stryker's party record.